How do you know if your little one's back to themselves again? Maybe it's the sound of them enjoying raspberries blown on their belly.
Or that wonderful silence when they're fast asleep. Ah, back to normal, whatever normal is.
Calpol Infant Suspension gets to work on fever in just 15 minutes. Available at your local Asda near you.
Calpol, let's kids be kids.
Calpol Sugar-Free Infant Suspension for infants 2 months plus, weighing over 4 kilograms and not premature. Contains paracetamol for pain and fever. Always read the label.
Halloween edition of the podcast for Sunday, October 31st, 2021. I am the Solemn Monster, the one time a year where my name actually kind of makes sense. I am hoping I will have time later on tonight. We shall see to watch the first three Halloween movies back to back to back. We'll see if I can carve out some time tonight. I always try to do that. It's my little Halloween tradition. I hope you guys are having a good Halloween. Probably fun for you with kids, right? Take them out, go trick-or-treating, maybe steal some of their candy for yourself. Hard to believe that next weekend marks 14 years since I started this show, but yes, indeed, we are coming up on the 14-year anniversary of The Sound Off, and I thank each and every one of you for joining me. I'm sure many of you have been part of a lot of Halloween shows in the past, so hopefully we'll make this one a good one like the rest. If you want to support the podcast, you may do so on thesolemonster.com. You'll find the PayPal button on the right-hand side of the page, including if you want to get any donations in for the anniversary show next week, you can do that as well. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out. I want to say Happy Halloween to these fine folks, including the Portland pop star Paul Hamilton. Paul, do not forget the big silver shamrock giveaway tonight at 9. Make sure you're in front of your TV. Night Stalker Naif Al-Safar, thank you. West Coast James Herrera, one of our long times. Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Killshot Keith Hart, the Moldovan Masochist Alexandru Mata, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, Ostentatious Alan Carter, New York Punk, Arnold Modesto, Caleb Showtime Lindley, John Raging Mad Riffle, the Firebomber, Craig Foster, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Yule, Millionaire, Matthew Forbush, thank you for the kind words, brother, I appreciate it. Deathblow David Floyd just celebrated his 30th birthday on Wednesday. I still remember the first half of my 30th birthday. Good times. And Deadwood Dylan Laporte, who was recently married to his lovely bride, Melissa, who I am told is a building scientist. Unlike many of the people I encounter on the internet who clearly are not rocket scientists, she is a building scientist. Who also loves D&D. She's a marvel, this lady. Marvelous. Marvelous Melissa Morledge. I have hereby dubbed thee. Congrats to the both of you on the nuptials. I wish you nothing but the best. And shout out to my friend Lee Sanders of the RCWR show on YouTube. He just returned from the latest Jericho cruise, which happened to be not only his first cruise, but also the first time he ever stepped onto an airplane and flew anywhere. So he did a whole write-up on the experience for anybody who may be on the fence about whether or not to go. The next cruise sets sail in March, so it's a quick turnaround if you're thinking about going. Visit the wrestling section at 411mania.com, and you can search for his article there. And he also has a video diary up on his channel as well. Just search for The RCWR Show on YouTube. And if you are one of our channel members on YouTube, a lot of new content went up this week, including two Q&A videos. It was cut up into two parts. So part one went up. That was over 40 minutes earlier in the week. A few days ago, I put up part two, which was about 35 minutes or so, answering your questions. And for our Legends tier members, retro episode number 12 of the podcast from January of 2008, the same day of the Royal Rumble pay-per-view at Madison Square Garden. So very excited to get ready that day to go to the Garden for the show. So it's a preview for that. Bobby Lashley leaving WWE, kind of a big shocking thing at that time. Mike Adamly joining the company. I had just gone and seen the new Rambo movie. It's like a little time capsule. You go back in time and you see what was going on back then. And it was interesting to go back and listen to some of that. So that's up for our Legends tier members. And thank you all for your support on there. 15 years ago, June 17th, 2006, I was inside the New Yorker Hotel, literally right next door to the Manhattan Center, a block away from Madison Square Garden, at a show called In Your Face, which was hosted by an independent promotion called Ring of Honor. I had never been to an ROH show before. This was my first. The very first match of the very first ROH show that I ever attended had Jay and Mark Briscoe against Jason Blade and Sterling James Keenan, who I now listen to every Monday night on Raw next to Jimmy Smith and Byron Saxton. I look at the rest of that card, and I see a lot of familiar names, and a lot of names that many of you are very familiar with. Austin Aries, Nigel McGuinness, Colt Cabana, Davey Richards, Adam Pearce, who just fined Brock Lesnar $1 million on SmackDown Friday night, Claudio Castagnoli, Homicide, Chris Hero, Kenta, Samoa Joe, and Bryan Danielson, who went on to headline two WrestleManias and just had an excellent match on Friday night with another ROH alum in Eddie Kingston. I missed the Murphy Rec Center days. That was before my time. I missed the CM Punk era of ROH as it was happening, and the first summer of Punk when he signed his WWE contract on the ROH belt. You know, that Punk guy went on to do some things. So did Tyler Black. So did El Generico. And Kevin Steen. And Adam Cole. These men, and ladies too, like Allison Danger and Lacey and Daisy Hayes, were all part of the foundation of that promotion, and it helped put many of them on the map. I have a lot of fond memories of being at those shows for Homicide's title win, for Danielson against Takeshi Morishima, Danielson against Kenta, for Bruno Sammartino's appearance, for some of those Steen and Generico battles, Joe against Kobashi. I wasn't there live for that one, but what a fucking battle that was. The ROH versus New Japan War of the World shows. I had more fun attending those Ring of Honor shows than almost any other show that I can think of. And I've been to a lot of shows over the years, going back to house shows in the 80s. And a ton of, you know, Raws, Wars, and pay-per-views, and eight WrestleManias. And you know, a lot of them I had a great deal of fun. But being at those Ring of Honor shows, you know, at the Manhattan Center when they were really just at their peak and firing on all cylinders, I can't think of any other show where I actually had more fun than I did attending those Ring of Honor shows. And I find it fascinating to trace the evolution of that company from that final show they did at the New Yorker Hotel to moving around the corner to the Manhattan Center, the Grand Ballroom, eight floors up. What a big deal that was at the time. And then later moving downstairs into the bigger Hammerstein Ballroom. And then eventually the Holy Grail, Madison Square Garden for the G1 Supercard. You can trace the evolution of Ring of Honor all within a two-block radius in that little slice of Midtown Manhattan. The top story this week is the demise of Ring of Honor. The company is not officially dead. It still lives on in name, and they insist that they are going to be back. But Ring of Honor, as we know it, Ring of Honor as it existed is dead. What we know is that they will still be running their November television tapings and their final battle pay-per-view on December 11th, after which they will be going dark through at least April of next year. All talent signed to deals that are expiring at the end of this year will not have those deals renewed, but they will be paid through the end of December. That includes all of their champions, everybody, regardless of their position on the card, no matter how big of a name you are, or you could be at the very bottom rung of the ladder, will no longer be under contract to Ring of Honor. If they have a deal that runs into next year, those people will remain under contract and be paid through March or April, at which point they too will no longer be under contract to Ring of Honor. Another sign that Ring of Honor, as we know it, is dead. When you basically release all of your talent, your entire talent roster, and allow them to go work elsewhere, you're basically back to operating as an independent promotion. Even though they're owned by a multi-billion dollar media company who can afford to fund them and pay those contracts if they wish, Sinclair is choosing not to do so. Many talents have already posted on social media that they are available immediately for bookings. Joe Koff, the chief operating officer for Ring of Honor, did a 30-minute interview with Mike Johnson on PWInsider.com that I listened to the same day that he spoke to the roster and their employees on a Zoom call to give them the bad news. He went right from the Zoom call to talking to Mike Johnson. You could hear it in his voice how emotional he was, almost defeated, but still trying his best not to be too bleak and to sound optimistic as much as he could about the future. He explained that they expanded, they signed new talent to big contracts, they tried to stay competitive, and they thought they could handle it, and then the pandemic hit, and they simply were not able to do it. And now they have to change their entire business plan. He said they're going to take the first quarter off and reimagine the product. There are few corporate buzzwords that make me roll my eyes more than when a company announces that they are reimagining something, or a movie studio is planning to reimagine an old movie, just because they're too uncreative to just put their muscle behind new movie concepts. We have to go back and reimagine movies that were already made 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. He said the product is going to have a different look going forward. It will not look anything like WWE or AEW or even the way Ring of Honor looks today. He literally, at one point during this interview, referred to, and I don't even know if he realized it when he did it, but he referred to Ring of Honor as Ring of Honor 2.0. He said that's what we're talking about here, ROH 2.0. Sinclair never poured the resources into Ring of Honor to get their production values up to the level of even an AEW, let alone a WWE. So the idea of an even more stripped-down version of their television show does not sound very appealing. Sean Ross Sapp reported that Koff told Talon he had multiple meetings trying his hardest to fight for ROH, but ultimately it was a Sinclair call. And I believe that, because this is not Joe Koff's decision to make here. This was completely a Sinclair Broadcast Group decision. One that I am sure he, like a lot of the talent and people who worked there, was shell-shocked by and not very happy about, and he probably did fight like hell to try to get them to change their mind, but it's not his call to make. If he is overruled by his overlords, then he has to abide by whatever it is that they want to do. This was absolutely a Sinclair call, not a Joe Koff call. So I can believe that. I can believe that he did in his mind what he felt he had to do to try to fight for Ring of Honor, and in the end, it simply was not enough. Now, Ring of Honor had issues even before the pandemic. Let's not put this all on the doorstep of COVID. It's very easy for people to just blame COVID for everything. Ring of Honor had problems long before there was a pandemic. But it was their handling of that pandemic, which I think deserves praise, that ultimately may have done them in. Unlike WWE and AEW, Ring of Honor went on a complete hiatus after COVID hit. They stopped running shows. They weren't airing any new content, in-ring content, on their weekly television show. They eventually started running shows again, but in empty buildings in front of no fans. They made no money from selling tickets or merch at arenas, all while paying talent, not just paying them on their contracts, but paying to also, you know, quarantine them at hotels so they could work those empty arena shows, paying for testing. You know, whatever the bylaws were there in the state of Maryland, they did what they felt they had to do, including putting talent up for a week or two at a time at some of these hotels so that they could work these shows. Maryland, of course, is where Sinclair is based, out of Baltimore. So, but they were paying people the entire time. They did not, you know, lay off a whole bunch of people. There were no mass layoffs. They took the health and safety of their wrestlers and their staff, by all accounts, very seriously, more so than any other promotion in this country. It's very much like what New Japan did, especially early on in the pandemic. There were New Japan executives. This is back when Harold Mage, I think, was still, you know, in charge over there. But I remember reading that some of the executives took pay cuts so that they wouldn't have to cut anyone's pay on the roster and they wouldn't have to get rid of anybody. So very similar situation here. I think New Japan and Ring of Honor both should be applauded for their handling of the pandemic, especially early on in the way that they, you know, they took it seriously, they tackled it. I don't think anybody can fault them for the steps that they took, especially early on, to make sure that they were, you know, protecting their people as much as they could. But now we see the chickens have come home to roost. There are consequences. Even the best intentions can sometimes have consequences. Sinclair is a big corporate entity. Big corporate entities do not like losing money. And what happened this week was the consequence of that. For all of their billions of dollars, Sinclair got tired of losing money on their little wrestling promotion. It's not unlike WWE releasing all of that talent last year and this year, when they're making more money than they ever have before. Their bottom line looks as great as ever. And they let go of scores, dozens of people. Some have come back, some were furloughed, some were brought back, many were not. But to them, it doesn't matter. It's about the bottom line. It's about tidying up the books. Sinclair operates in much the same way. Now, I said that there were issues even before the pandemic. There was a reason that I said on this podcast years ago that Triple H and WWE were looking to weaken what, at the time, was a thriving independent scene. When he decided to turn the NXT brand into his own personal super indie. Which is basically what he did. He did that, though. He built that super indie under the WWE umbrella on the back of Ring of Honor. And a lot of talent from that promotion. He began raiding more and more talent from the ROH roster. And making it very appealing for them to come over and sign with WWE. And give them the impression that, well, you come work for NXT. NXT is the hot thing. And then eventually you make your way up to Raw. You make your way up to SmackDown. You make even more money. You become a big star. It's no wonder. All those people took the money. They took all the hopes and everything that came with that. And they went for WWE. It was more appealing than sticking around with Ring of Honor because they saw a ceiling with Ring of Honor. Ring of Honor could only offer them so much. Ring of Honor was always that alternate that you could look to for great wrestling that you wouldn't always find on the WWE main roster. Eventually, that WWE main roster was, and still is in many ways, made up of talent that they took from Ring of Honor. And all of a sudden, Ring of Honor wasn't the belle of the ball anymore. They weren't the hot product anymore for hardcore wrestling fans the way they used to be. NXT was gaining steam with their takeover shows. Takeover being the key word. And I said at the time, if I'm Ring of Honor, if I'm Joe Koff, I'm watching my back and my front. Because that was not going to end well for them. That was the first thing that really hurt them. They lost their cool factor. And then along came Tony Khan and AEW. And that only drove the dagger deeper into their chest. It was a slow death. It was not instant. They sort of bled out. It goes back to the All-In pay-per-view in 2018 that Ring of Honor helped produce. In fact, they still own the footage of that event, right? Some people are under the impression that AEW has that footage because there was a lot of AEW talent on that show. AEW does not own that footage because AEW didn't even officially exist at that point. Ring of Honor helped produce the event, which is still the biggest independent wrestling show ever produced. And, you know, use that word independent kind of loosely, given the Ring of Honor backing. So, is it truly independent if you had backing from Ring of Honor? It was still, though, considered the biggest independent event ever produced. And it was a big success. Little did the folks at Ring of Honor know that they were engineering the start of their own demise. It was shortly after that show, despite their best efforts to keep them, and they tried. They presented a very lucrative offer to Matt and Nick Jackson to keep the Young Bucks. It didn't work, and the Bucks decided it was time to move on, and they, along with Kenny Omega and along with Hangman Page and others, Cody Rhodes, all left Ring of Honor at the same time to join this upstart AEW promotion, which did something that Ring of Honor never did. In all the years they existed, even Impact was able to get on a major cable television station years ago. And for a while, they were pulling in. They were averaging over 1 million viewers a week. AEW did something Ring of Honor never could do. They got television on a major cable network on TNT, the home of WCW Monday Nitro. And it was the success of that All-In pay-per-view, ultimately, that convinced the brass and the suits at TNT, you know what? This could be a viable thing. Let's go ahead and take a chance on this. I mean, think about the absurdity of this. TNT is a major television network. They took a chance on a wrestling company that had no track record of television before. How does that happen? How often does something like that happen? Ring of Honor, much like Impact, had been around up to that point for almost 20 years. And they could never get a station like TNT to take a chance on them. They had syndicated television, but they, you know, syndicated television on certain networks throughout the country is different. It's not the same. You don't have the same level of, you know, penetration and the same level of reach that you're going to get on a station like a USA Network or a TNT or a TBS or something like that. It kind of reminds me of the story of Spike TV going to Vince McMahon for his blessing back in 2005 to put this new reality show on after Monday Night Raw called The Ultimate Fighter. UFC may have been on its last legs at that point were it not for the success of that show and that show taking off in the way that it did, which led to big pay-per-view business for them. Because they were able to use that show as a vehicle to promote their fights on pay-per-view, which was and still is in many ways, although less so now because they have this guaranteed money. But back then, it was all about pay-per-view dollars. And The Ultimate Fighter is what really just kind of launched them into the stratosphere. That doesn't happen if Vince McMahon doesn't look at Spike TV and say, yeah, sure, go ahead. Go ahead, put that on after Raw. UFC may not have been around that much longer. Or Dana White certainly maybe wouldn't still be involved with them to this day. If maybe they got sold off to somebody else, because UFC business-wise was not doing very well at that point. Paul Heyman claimed to be in the room when Vince McMahon decided to let The Ultimate Fighter air after Raw because they had the right, I guess, to approve or reject any programming that came on after their show. And again, he said sure, and Heyman says he warned him not to do that because they should be very afraid of anyone who could take pay-per-view dollars away from them. But remember what WWE used to publicly argue. We're two completely different products. We don't look at them as competition. We're entertainment. They're in the fight business. It's two completely different things. Of course, we all know that's bullshit, and there was a lot of overlap between the two audiences. As different as they are, they're very similar. They attract very similar audiences. UFC went on to take a lot of pay-per-view dollars away from WWE. These decisions can come back to bite you on the ass. Now, even still, ROH was the de facto number two wrestling promotion in this country only a couple of years ago. This was before AEW ran that first Double or Nothing show in Las Vegas and before Dynamite premiered on TNT later that year in October. Ring of Honor had the potential to be that number two and to stay that number two promotion. They sold out Madison Square Garden with a little bit of help from New Japan. I can tell you, as somebody who was at that show, there seemed to be more excitement for the New Japan side of things than the ROH side. And when the show was over, the prevailing thought was Ring of Honor really shit the bed with that show, and it was all about New Japan. But that was a huge milestone. No wrestling company other than one run by a McMahon had run the Garden since 1960. WWE tried to stop them. They tried to sabotage them and stop them from running Madison Square Garden. Sinclair lawyers had to step in and they were able to stop their bullshit and get that reversed. Not only did they run the building, they sold it out. But they sold it out largely on the backs of Omega and the Bucks. When people initially bought those tickets, they thought that they were going to be on the show. They thought, hey, it's going to be the Elite, which was really, you know, super over at that point among the hardcore fans. They were expecting the Elite crew were going to be there, but they weren't, because by the time the show actually came along, those guys were gone. They had decided to leave. They were no longer working for New Japan. They were no longer working for Ring of Honor. Now, would they have still sold out if people knew the Elite guys were not going to be there? Maybe. If only because it was WrestleMania weekend, and so I think with all those fans in town, and just, you know, the whole attraction of it being the first time a non-WWE wrestling show is at the Garden, I think they may have had a shot, but it would have been a lot more difficult for them to fill that building the way they did. After that, though, when that show was over, it was all downhill. Remember, they gave Marty Scurll the biggest contract in Ring of Honor history to not only wrestle for them, but also book for them. They gave him the book. He never even got through one chapter. I don't even think he got through one page of that book before he was gone. This was a once-in-a-lifetime offer. He took that over joining his friends in AEW, and everybody expected him to go along with the Bucks and Kenny and Paige and all of them. He should have been part of that crew. But he had this amazing offer where he could wrestle, he could book, he's making more money than he's ever made in his life. You can understand why he would take that offer over going somewhere else. And then, when the speaking out movement started, that spelled the end of Marty Scurll's tenure with Ring of Honor. He never even got to implement whatever his creative plans were going to be. They put all their eggs in his basket, and he never got to do anything for them. And he was gone. They had that investigation that went on forever, but, you know, as long as that investigation was dragging on for, you kind of knew how it was going to end, and it ended predictably, and he never worked for them again. Today, Ring of Honor has not been hot for a while. It has been ice cold. NXT recently rebranded, again, as developmental. But AEW is still the new kid on the block. GCW is gaining more ground with each passing month. You also have MLW, you have Impact, which is nowhere near its peak. But the wrestling landscape is very different than it was when Ring of Honor was at its peak. There's a lot more wrestling now than there was back then. If anything, the market is oversaturated with wrestling. There's almost too much wrestling. That makes it very difficult for Ring of Honor to stand out from the rest. They used to have something about them that made them stand out, that made them different, that made them appealing. But now here we are, 10 plus years later, since you know, they were off their peak. And what is it that Ring of Honor really brings to the table that you won't find in some or all of these other promotions? What is it about them that makes them unique and stand out? It's a lot harder to really identify what that is today, harder now than it would have been back then. The fact that they're not committing to April as an absolute return date does not inspire a lot of confidence. It sounds like a date based more on hopes and aspirations than anything concrete. But as of this moment, they do plan on coming back in some form. What form that takes is going to be up to Sinclair. Does Sinclair even want to keep Ring of Honor alive? They own 100% of the company, so it's their decision to make. If they want to keep it alive, they'll keep it alive. If they want it to die a quiet death, then it will die a quiet death. But ultimately, it is going to be their decision to make. And if the answer to that question is yes, what does that even look like? What does a reimagined Ring of Honor in 2022 and beyond even look like? You know, Sinclair is already committed to airing that new WOW Women of Wrestling show on its stations next fall. Maybe they look at that and they figure, you know what, that's enough wrestling for us. We already have a new wrestling show that's going to be starting up in about a year, and we're going to be airing it. Maybe that's enough wrestling for us. The fall of ROH can be traced to a handful of decisions of their own making and a few that were out of their control, but it ultimately falls on how they reacted to those decisions. Had Sinclair really gone all in, no pun intended, I mean, technically they did go all in and they got fucked for it. But had they gone all in on Ring of Honor and poured more money into production and you know, trying to retain at least some of the talent that left, we probably would not be talking about this right now. The top story this week would be something else. Sinclair saved Ring of Honor in 2011. Kerry Silkin, he couldn't afford to keep funding it on his own. And had Sinclair not made the offer they did at that time, the demise of Ring of Honor would have happened 10 years ago. But if you're looking to place blame on someone's doorstep, that doorstep is the corporate offices of Sinclair Broadcast Group in Baltimore. And to make matters worse, they announced that because of the cyber attack that hit Sinclair a few weeks ago, which they're still reeling from, that they would be airing an encore episode of Ring of Honor television this weekend on Jay Lethal in place of their weekly show because Sinclair is still having what they call technical difficulties. That's how bad this ransomware attack was. They still can't air their own television show because of technical difficulties. It's been going on for like 2 weeks now. And I guess they have no access to whatever hard drive or footage that they shot the footage that was originally going to air this week, so they have to air a clip show. But I feel bad for the talent. You know, the Briscoes, they've been there forever. Jonathan Gresham, you hear a lot about him. Roosh, Bandito, Brody King, Dragon Lee, EC3. There is no shortage of great talent on the Ring of Honor roster. They will all find work somewhere. I don't know how many of them are going to go to AEW. I don't know how many of them might look to go overseas. I don't know how many of them are just going to work random independent dates. Maybe some of them will end up back in Ring of Honor. If they do reboot and they do come back, they might not be under contract, but maybe some of them do come back and work for Ring of Honor. I feel bad for them. I feel bad for the employees, like Ian Riccaboni, who's a really good announcer, and Brian Zane, who I consider a friend and who I know really enjoyed working there. Sports Illustrated had a report claiming that their sizable tape library is available to the highest bidder and that they have been privately trying to move the library and shop it around for more than a year, but that they're asking for a much higher price tag than there is actual interest in the content. Brian Alvarez heard from multiple sources that dispute this and say the library is not for sale at this point. I think the truth probably lies somewhere in the middle where it's the WWE thing. Are you for sale or are you not for sale? What do you always hear Vince McMahon and Nick Khan saying? They're not out on the front lawn with a giant sign saying, for sale, come talk to us. But the lines of communication are always open. And if somebody has an offer, we're more than willing to sit down and listen to what they have to say. And I think that's the same that applies here. I think if WWE or AEW or somebody came along with a humongous offer and they wanted that Ring of Honor library, especially now, I mean, given everything that's happened over the last few days and we see what the situation is, and obviously they're losing money and Sinclair is looking to make changes. If somebody came along and was going to dump a whole bunch of money and back the Brinks truck up to get that tape library, I am sure that Ring of Honor and Sinclair and Joe Koff would be more than interested in hearing what they have to say. And if and when that tape library is for sale, Tony Khan should be all over that, if for no other reason but to get access to that all-in footage. But now they have people like Punk and Danielson on their roster. They can make money off all of that archival footage if they ever set up their own streaming platform or if they decide to sell DVDs. Tony Schiavone said he thinks AEW is going to have its own streaming service by the end of 2022. That would be a nice get for them. WWE, of course, they have their network on Peacock. Who knows what they would plan to do with it, but they also have a ton of former Ring of Honor talent under contract where that footage could be valuable. And they have licensed footage before from Ring of Honor for their DVDs and such. I think, in fact, when they did that big three-disc set years ago on CM Punk, I think there was Ring of Honor footage in there. So they have licensed footage from them before. If they had full access to it, there's a lot that they could do with it. But to wrap this up, if you watched Monday Night Raw this week, you saw names like Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, Damian Priest. If you watched Dynamite or Rampage, you saw CM Punk, Bryan Danielson, The Young Bucks, Adam Cole, Bobby Fish. All are men who cut their teeth working for Ring of Honor. And whether you are a fan of it or not, the in-ring style that we see on television these days can largely be credited to ROH. You cannot minimize the influence that this independent promotion once upon a time, independent promotion has had on the overall wrestling landscape, not unlike the influence that ECW had on WWF and WCW back during the Monday Night War. And ECW ended up getting better television than Ring of Honor ever had. But here's this little renegade promotion and the influence that they had in terms of, you know, the talent they use, in terms of, you know, the hardcore style of matches and some of the international talent they brought in from Japan and Mexico and places like that. The impact is immeasurable that ECW had on WCW and WWF. There probably would be no Attitude Era were it not for ECW. Ring of Honor had a similar level of influence on modern day wrestling. And again, you may think that's a bad thing. Whether you think it's bad or good is irrelevant to the point that I'm making. The influence cannot be understated. And it is very sad to see at least this incarnation of Ring of Honor come to an end in this way. But the era of Honor will live on every week when you put on USA Network and you put on Fox and you put on TNT. Whether you realize it or not, you are seeing it. And I will always look back with a smile on those shows that I attended, even the ones with the doormen who used to laugh and call me Baby Dragon when they would rip my ticket. I took it as a compliment. WWE released its pay-per-view schedule for next year, and it was a newsworthy announcement for a few reasons. WrestleMania will once again be a two-night event, April 2nd and April 3rd, from AT&T Stadium in Dallas, where they set their all-time attendance record at WrestleMania 32. As someone who was at that WrestleMania, and every one of them from 28 to 35, they all got progressively longer and harder to sit through. So if splitting it up over two nights means no more seven-hour WrestleManias in one night, then I think it's a good move. Two-night WrestleManias are likely going to be the norm going forward, which is a trend that New Japan started with its Wrestle Kingdom show last year. This January coming up, Wrestle Kingdom is actually moving to three nights, but only the first two are at the Tokyo Dome, and then night three is a few days later in a smaller building. There are Thursdays open in February and in October that are going to be the annual Saudi Arabia shows. So we don't know exactly what the dates or the names of those are going to be just yet. And like this year, there is no pay-per-view listed for the month of December, although that could change, you know, at some point next year. But this is what the schedule looks like at this time. On January 1st, they're running their first ever New Year's Day pay-per-view in Atlanta called Day One. And then later on in January, there's a second pay-per-view, that of course being the Royal Rumble, on January 29th from the Dome in St. Louis. I think they've already sold over 20,000 tickets for that show. I don't know if they're allotting for 30 or 40,000, probably be somewhere around 30-ish. April 2nd and 3rd, WrestleMania at AT&T Stadium in Dallas. May 8th will be a show in Providence, Rhode Island, at the Dunkin' Donuts Center. June 5th, a show to be named at a later date from the Allstate Arena in Chicago. July 2nd is Money in the Bank at Allegiant Stadium in Las Vegas. July 30th is SummerSlam at Nissan Stadium in Nashville. September 3rd or 4th will be a show to be named at a city to be named later. More on that in a second. And November 26th will be Survivor Series from the TD Garden in Boston. So a few things to unpack here. The majority of those dates fall on a Saturday, 6 out of the 10 events, in fact, fall on a Saturday. So WWE is moving towards Saturday pay-per-views more and more. We knew Money in the Bank would be a stadium show for the first time. What we did not know is that for the first time ever, SummerSlam will happen in July and not August like it has every other year since the very first one in 1988. That makes 2 stadium shows for WWE in 1 month. And that means no SummerSlam from the UK for the 30th anniversary of the Wembley show in 1992. However, it does look like the UK is getting a stadium show over Labor Day weekend instead, either that Saturday or Sunday. Per the Observer, WWE met with officials for both Wembley Stadium and Cardiff's Millennium Stadium recently about a Labor Day weekend show. What makes this all very interesting is that Labor Day weekend is traditionally when AEW holds its all-out pay-per-view in Chicago, which is their biggest event of the year. And now, all of a sudden, WWE is running a pay-per-view on Labor Day weekend. That is not a coincidence. Even if the WWE show airs earlier in the day in the US and does not go head-to-head with AEW, which it may not, if they end up taking place on the same day, it's still a major pay-per-view to promote that weekend that could take some of the piss out of the AEW show. For me, I just hope they don't air on the same day, because I want to be able to stream live right after each show. And if they air the same day, like if the WWE show airs in the afternoon, and it literally goes right into the AEW pay-per-view, what was that, like 9 straight hours of wrestling? And here we are talking about 2 nights of WrestleMania, right? Thank God, no 7-hour WrestleMania in one night. I don't need 9 hours of WWE and AEW back-to-back on the same day. And I don't want to have to pick and choose which one I can, you know, stream a review for. So for me personally, I am hoping that they do not air on the same day. Well, all of a sudden, we have another competition here to see who books and produces the better show, which in the end will be good for the fans, again, so long as they don't air on the same day. But it's going to make for a very busy weekend. One thing I can say is that the UK audience is overdue for a major pay-per-view, and I'm glad they're finally getting one. With everything on Peacock now, time zone differences don't matter anymore. They just aired a Saudi Arabia show at noon on a Thursday. I don't want to hear about this time zone bullshit anymore. No more excuses. It's time for the UK to get their own pay-per-view. Not a lot of news on the AEW front this week. We've got 2 weeks until the Full Gear pay-per-view. Darby Allin against MJF is now official. Darby returned on Wednesday on Dynamite in the crowd, dressed up as the Invisible Man. I guess that was his Halloween costume, although he wears his Halloween costume on TV every week. He chased away MJF, he made the match official. The best thing on the show on Wednesday was the TBS title tournament match between Serena Deeb and Hikaru Shida. And I thought that, you know, they had a very good first match together on TV many weeks ago when Serena denied Shida her 50th AEW win, so this was the rematch, and Shida got her win back here. She did finally earn her 50th win, but I thought the match itself was excellent. They did a big injury angle when it was over with Serena attacking her and going after her knee. She clipped her knee. She put on the Serenity Lock. She was beating her down with a steel chair. I loved Serena paying homage to Bret the Hitman Hart. She was wearing the pink and black for her match. She used the figure four spot around the ring post. She borrowed the finish from the Bret Hart-Davey Boy Smith match from SummerSlam at Wembley Stadium. That is the second AEW star to pay tribute to the Hitman. CM Punk CM Punk and Darby Allin both pay tribute to him in their match at All Out. It's nice to see him getting some love. But I wanted to mention an idea here because I was I got a message from Jordan. Shout out to Jordan Di Paola. He had proposed an idea, which is that Shida would be unable to compete for the remainder of the tournament after the injury angle they did on Wednesday. Nyla Rose already has a bye into the next round. So they would do a battle royal to determine who would face her, and Serena would win the battle royal and then goes on to win the entire tournament. So you have the person who lost in the opening round found a way to win the entire thing, and then eventually it sets up a rematch with Serena defending the title against Shida. And I had thought about that, not the Battle Royal part, but I had thought about the idea that after what happened on TV this week, Shida might not be cleared to compete. And Serena is automatically inserted into the next round because just by virtue of Shida not being able to compete, even though Serena was responsible, she should then be the one to take that spot because the person who beat her can't go. So then Serena would go on to win the entire thing and win the championship because I had picked her originally to win the entire thing. So I guess I'm going to keep hope alive, see what they do on TV this week. I don't think it's a totally shut door yet on the idea that Serena Deeb could come out of this tournament as the new TBS Women's Champion. But if you missed that match, that to me was, it's right up there with the match we saw on Friday as the match of the week. Because on Friday on Rampage, we got Bryan Danielson against Eddie Kingston in a different tournament, the AEW World Title Men's Eliminator. And the two of them went out there and they had a great fucking match. Bryan, of course, got the win. I don't think anybody really was thinking that the outcome would be any different. But when the match was over, Bryan went to go shake hands with Eddie. Eddie left the ring instead, you know, because he's a proud man. Obviously, he's not very happy about the fact that he passed out in a submission hold and denies the fact that he ever passed out. That was his argument. But it was a fantastic wrestling match. And as I said on Friday, Danielson's run of great matches continues in AEW. He has been perfect so far. He is finding different ways to win in every single match, trying to change things up just a little bit, not just do the same old shit, the same old finish to every match. No two matches that he has had so far are the same. And the match that he is going to have with Jon Moxley in Full Gear, and it will be Jon Moxley. Moxley still has to get past Orange Cassidy on TV this week. He will. And we're going to get Danielson and Mox in the finals at Full Gear. And that match is also going to be quite great. But they had a segment in the back after the match where CM Punk was being interviewed by Tony Schiavone. And they were interrupted by this commotion. Eddie Kingston was in the back. He was ranting and raving and not very happy. And he looked over and saw what he perceived to be a smirk or a smile on the face of CM Punk. And he came over to confront him and he had to be, you know, taken away. So it looks like CM Punk has found an opponent for Full Gear. Now, they have 2 weeks to promote this match. They haven't made it official yet. 2 weeks is more than enough. The promos that we are probably going to get between these two men are going to be a lot of fun. And the idea that I floated on the stream on Friday night after Rampage, you do these singles matches. You do Bryan and Mox in the tournament finals at the pay-per-view. You do Punk one-on-one against Eddie Kingston. Punk has been very vocal about the fact that he wants to, at some point soon, work with Bryan Danielson. It has been a very, very long time since the two of them have worked together. Whether it's against each other, whether it's tag team partners, he wants to work with Danielson. And now we see the makings. It's taking shape. It's taking form of a potential tag team match coming out of the pay-per-view. Maybe if they do a big Winter is Coming type episode of Dynamite in December, where we could have as an attraction on TV, CM Punk and Bryan Danielson together as tag team partners, taking on Jon Moxley and Eddie Kingston, who by that point might be full on heels. But I think for sure I'd be shocked if we didn't get that tag team match at some point in the next couple of months. Punk and Danielson against Moxley and Kingston, I think, is coming. Now, some other news and notes. WWE released Greg Hamilton this week after 5 years there as a ring announcer, 6 years total with the company. It was sudden because he had just appeared at Crown Jewel and SmackDown the following night. And it may have had a little something to do with him going after rapper Westside Gunn in a series of Instagram comments. Westside Gunn is a big wrestling fan. He's got songs dedicated to wrestlers. He was in the crowd at Arthur Ashe Stadium for the AEW Grand Slam show in September. Mr. Hamilton tried to pick a fight with Mr. Gunn by threatening to send WWE lawyers after him for using a sample of his voice on one of his tracks. And this is what Greg had to say. He said, "Well, Westside Gunn, let's hope that since you stole my voice for your incoherent kindergarten fables, that you saved up enough delivering for DoorDash, because you are," And then it's censored. I assume that says fucked. You'll be paying me for years. Apologize, and I'll think about not collecting every dime for the rest of your life. Or I can get WWE lawyers. That's okay, too. Settle with my lawyer, and don't ever use my voice again. So wrong. And then there was another comment where he said, TikTok, apparently he's Karrion Kross now. TikTok, the longer this goes, the longer I have in court. You ready to settle, or do you want to dance with WWE lawyers? It's a slam dunk. Price goes up by the day. It was 20K, but at noon Eastern, it's 30K, and we go to court. What is this, high noon? He sounded like he was one more cocktail away from challenging the man to one of those old Western duels. The minute he mentioned WWE lawyers, like he controlled them, I'm going to sick WWE lawyers on you. He sealed his fate. That was it. But if you take his word for it, it was a mutual parting of the ways. Ah, yes, of course it was. A mutual respect departure is what he called it. Yes, they released him and he mutually accepted it. Bray Wyatt is officially a free agent. His 90-day non-compete with WWE expired on Friday. Impact Wrestling reportedly made a play for him and they couldn't work out a deal. Fightful reports that he has been spotted in Los Angeles and that he has been fielding inquiries about potential Hollywood projects. Tony Khan, we know, has publicly said he would love to have a conversation with him, but, you know, hearing the Hollywood thing, it makes a lot of sense. I made that very point on the podcast a long time ago. I thought it was a missed opportunity by WWE not casting him in his own horror film for WWE Studios. In fact, you could have done a whole film just based around the Wyatt family with him and Luke Harper and Eric Rowan, let alone The Fiend. That was a huge missed opportunity, I thought. They did that with Kane, right? They had Kane in those See No Evil movies. And I think Bray would be a better actor in a movie like that than Kane was. A lot of what he did on WWE television seemed more suited for the silver screen. This doesn't surprise me at all. But he's also teasing to tell all about his experience in WWE after Ringside News reported that a well-placed source in WWE told them if you were running a business and Wyndham Rotunda was on your payroll, you would release him too. Between his backstage antics and the way he handled himself when making millions while medically flagged, he really deserved to be released. That is what their supposed WWE source had to say, to which Bray responded on Twitter, "Now that we have Johnny and Bruce's opinion, I would like to share mine soon." That is one shoot interview I am looking forward to hearing. WWE is getting ready for a tour of the UK next month, and it was announced this week that Walter will be working 4 SmackDown Live events on that tour, November 7th in Liverpool, November 8th in Leeds, November 9th in Nottingham, and November 10th in Manchester. And his opponent on those 4 dates will be Cesaro. And we're not seeing any of them on TV, and that makes me very sad. But if you are attending any of those shows, you are in for a treat. No trick. All treat. A week after I talked about Jim Ross being diagnosed with skin cancer, I hate that I have to use that dreaded C word yet again, Hacksaw Jim Duggan announced this week that he was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He was actually diagnosed a couple of months ago, and he has been living with it and getting ready for what's to come. He underwent an emergency operation last week. He didn't tell us what it was for. And then he revealed his diagnosis this week and had another surgery on Friday that his wife said was a success. So it's not the first time that Duggan has battled cancer. He beat kidney cancer over 20 years ago when he was working for WCW, and he'll beat this too. We're all pulling for Hacksaw. And congrats to Chad Gable, who graduated from Full Sail University this week with his master's in media design, and he was also named the valedictorian of his class. That's quite a step up from the Alpha Academy. He posted on Instagram, right near the top of the list of things I would never have believed if you told me 2 years ago is that I would be going back to school. Motion graphics, animation, and digital filmmaking have been a passion of mine since I was 14 years old, and is what I chose to pursue for my bachelor's degree, which I received in 2010. Early on in the pandemic, the extra time and change in schedule led me to decide that I did not want to come out on the other side of it without using these things for something positive. So there's your feel-good story of the week from Chad Gable. Now they just have to actually start doing something meaningful with him on television. But I fear he may end up with a valedictorian gimmick. The gimmick they gave to Andre Chase on NXT, we might be seeing Chad Gable doing something like that soon on the main roster.
Hey, it's Chris VanVleet. You may have seen my videos on YouTube, but I also have a podcast.
It's Chris-a-mania, brother.
Each week, I sit down with the biggest names in pro wrestling for in-depth conversations to find out what makes the greatest performers so great.
That's a great question. Look at you, man, with the powerful questions.
Just search for the Chris VanVleet Show wherever you're listening right now.
Ladies and gentlemen, Chris
Chris has a new interview up with the latest addition to the AEW roster, Tony Nese, talking about who he would like to face there, being released by WWE, winning the Cruiserweight title at WrestleMania. They talk about some bodybuilding, some interesting stuff at the beginning about tracking calories and macros and all that kind of stuff. I don't look anything like Tony Nese, but I track a lot of that stuff too in an app on my phone. So it was interesting hearing about what his routine is, including why he eats ice cream every night. So look for Insight with Chris VanVleet wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Of course, you can find the video version of it on YouTube, but Chris has a podcast as well with all of his interviews, so make sure you add it to your playlist if you have not already done so. Speaking of ice cream, that reminds me, I have to give a shout out to Jolly Llama and the very nice care package they sent me the other day. I have become a big fan of their products since I discovered them recently because they make dairy-free and gluten-free as well for those who need to eat gluten-free. But for me, I look for dairy-free ice cream and sorbet. I only recently had my first ice cream cone in, I would say, had to be every bit of 25 years. Oh my God, I can't believe I've been missing out for so long. They have these vanilla fudge sundae cones, as well as these caramel chocolate chip cones. Absolutely delicious. So if you are looking for something that is dairy and or gluten free, and you really like ice cream, the brand is called Jolly Llama. If you go to jollyllama.com, you can search and see if they stock it in a store near you, or you can order directly off their site. I don't have a promo code or anything to offer you. This is just me giving them a ringing endorsement here. I love that I can eat ice cream again, ice cream cones, a couple times a week, three times a week, maybe four, maybe five. All right, maybe seven times a week. It's great. They also have ice cream sandwiches too. So go to the website and check them out. Raw Monday night was built. We go from an ice cream cone to Monday Night Raw. Talk about a come down here. Monday Night Raw was billed as the season premiere and the start of a new era with the roster changes finally taking effect. There wasn't much that felt different about it. The new era looks and feels very much like the old era, even with all the blue faces that are now red. Of all the things that needed to change on this show, Damian Priest's entrance was not one of them, but they saw fit to change that. They also added a growling noise to Keith Lee's music. Or the sound of someone belching, I'm not sure. I've never heard a fucking cat make that noise before, unless it was being strangled, maybe. The next time you drink too much soda and you let one rip, you'll think of Bearcat Lee. Because when I heard, that's the first thing I thought of. It sounded like somebody was burping when he first came out. By the time the show was over, Seth Rollins had won the right to challenge for the WWE Championship. The man who lost inside Hell in a Cell to Edge, who was not on this show. Rollins lost, but now he is the number one contender. They had the open parade of interruptions during Big E's opening promo. First with Rollins coming out, then Rey Mysterio, then Finn Balor, and finally Kevin Owens. Every single one of these people were on SmackDown just a few months ago. They basically just took everything from SmackDown, not name Roman Reigns or the Usos, and they move them to Monday. But it did set up a fatal four-way ladder match that was the best thing on the show. Dolph Ziggler and Big Bob won a triple threat match over the Street Profits and the Alpha Academy, the SmackDown tag team division a month ago with the Usos. Ziggler and Rude won, which earned them a Raw tag team title match later in the night, where they lost to Randy Orton and Matt Riddle. RK-Bro was one of the only acts the crowd seemed to give a shit about on this show, or react to with any real enthusiasm on the entire show. It's strange how they announced it would be Orton and Riddle defending against AJ Styles and Omos, and yet again, up until a few hours before the show when the match was pulled, that was the planned match. I know this comes as a shock to you that they would announce something days in advance and then pull it the day of the show, but it's true. It really happened. It's almost as if somebody looked at the script and didn't like what he saw and decided to blow a whole bunch of things up. Who would have ever heard of such a thing? Nothing screams new era more than doing the same match for the third or fourth time. So maybe they realized it was a little too ridiculous even for them. We can't put these four guys in the ring again, so let's just change it up a little bit. Zelina Vega had her royal coronation as queen, and then had a rematch against Doudrop that she won when she hit Doudrop with her scepter behind the referee's back. That was not the only women's match that we had. We got Carmella against Liv Morgan. Again. New era. Same old shit. Whether it's Mondays or Fridays, it makes no difference. And Liv Morgan lost again. Becky Lynch came out for a promo, and it is so obvious that these people want to cheer for her. They want to cheer for this woman. The moment she started playing heel, they went quiet. She was interrupted by Bianca Belair, who pointed out that she beat Charlotte Flair last week in their Raw Women's title match, albeit by DQ. And now that Lynch is the Raw Women's champion, that entitles her to another match for the title. Becky told her to get to the back of the line, bitch, which led to Belair going after her, and Becky accepted her challenge, and it is official for Raw tomorrow night. It'll be Becky Lynch against Bianca Belair for the Raw Women's Championship. Bianca Belair should have beaten Charlotte last week for the title, and they didn't do it. Could have avoided a lot of the headaches that they had if they did. Now they can make it right. I would belt Bianca. And either do Bianca against Charlotte at Survivor Series or have... I was going to say have Sasha Banks take the SmackDown Women's title from Charlotte on TV and do the match that I suggested last week. The SummerSlam match that never was at Survivor Series. But after the angle they did with Shotzi Blackheart on Friday, it doesn't look like Sasha Banks is going to be getting her hands on that championship anytime soon. I was going to say, because if you did it the other way, and you actually put the belts on Sasha and Bianca before the next pay-per-view, that becomes the Survivor Series match. And you could always, you know, have Becky and Charlotte captain their own Survivor Series teams against each other, Raw versus SmackDown. Damian Priest has dropped the Arrow stuff that he does when he comes out to the ring. It's no more. No more. He is no longer the Archer of Infamy, I guess. Or the infamous Archer, whatever the fuck he calls himself. He has lost interest in archery. Maybe he'll take up something else. Maybe he'll take up fencing. Maybe he'll take up some other sport. But he's also been given new music. I don't think a single person said, you know what's wrong with Damian Priest? His music sucks. He needs new music. And the new music isn't even terrible or anything. I've heard much worse. But there was absolutely nothing wrong with his music or his entrance before. In fact, I have complimented them multiple times on this podcast. One of the few things I will compliment Monday Night Raw on each week is the job they've been doing of building up Damian Priest. Don't do anything to fuck that up. He beat T-Bar. New era of Raw. You would think poor Dijakovic could at least ditch the horrible T-Bar shit. T-Bar threw one of those giant announcer chairs at Priest for the disqualification, those big office chairs, and Priest just lost it. He just snapped. He beat the hell out of him. He put him back in the ring and laid him out with the Reckoning. A more aggressive, less smiley Damian Priest. I can get behind that. Dijak is not going anywhere if he stays as T-Bar. I mean, other than the unemployment line next spring after WrestleMania. I hate to say it, but let's be honest, I'm not the only one thinking that. Sadly, even if they did change his name, he's probably on the bubble regardless. You can tell a lot about what they think of certain people just based on the way they're used or not used on TV. I'm not telling you something that you people don't already know. I'm just saying it out loud for the world to hear. Carmella beat Liv Morgan in a 3-minute match. She wore her glitter mask again. She and Corey Graves announced their engagement this past week. I think she should wear that mask to the wedding. Keep kayfabe. Commit to the gimmick. We then had Keith Bearcat Lee belching all the way down to the ring for a squash win over Cedric Alexander. No Bobby Lashley on this show, and MVP, of course, is still out from his knee surgery, so this Hurt Business reunion is not nearly as interesting as I had hoped it would be. Lee destroyed him, and every few seconds now he does this roar sound. Rawr! Rawr! Every few seconds he has to do the roar. I can 100% believe that is a Vince McMahon thing. Keith Lee did an interview and said that Vince McMahon has been very hands-on with the changes to his character. No shit. You don't say. We all can see that. If that's what Vince McMahon wants and he likes what he sees, you know what? Maybe he'll end up with a decent push out of it. At least until the old man gets bored. They could build him up for a program with Big E. But the growling and the Bearcat stuff is just ridiculous. And yes, I understand, for the people who are going to once again mention, I know who Bearcat Wright was. I have talked about Bearcat Wright on this show before. Keith Lee is not Bearcat Wright. He is not a bear, nor is he a cat. He's fucking Keith Lee. These little teasers where they talk about him clawing his way to Raw are ridiculous. This is not a tribute to Bearcat Lee. This is a Vince McMahon idea because he's got to put his little stamp on everything. Everybody's got to have a gimmick or a nickname or a this or a that. That's what this is. This was not Keith Lee waking up one day or Vince McMahon waking up one day in a cold sweat and saying, you know what? I just had this amazing dream. I remembered Bearcat Lee or Bearcat Wright. I'm fucking his name up now. Bearcat Wright. We need to pay tribute to this man. How can we have gone all these years without paying tribute to this wonderful man? That's never what this was about. This is some gimmick bullshit that Vince McMahon has put upon this man. I mean, this week I half expect them to put a fucking litter box next to the ring for him when he comes out. How long before his opponents start baiting him with catnip? I hate how they have to put their little stamp on everything when it's not needed. Some people actually need that. Some people who maybe aren't as experienced as Keith Lee. Or maybe they don't look the way that Keith Lee looks. They need a little bit of extra help. Sometimes you give somebody the right gimmick and they run with it and it works and they get it over and they make a lot of money and you look back on it and go, you know what? Thank God for that gimmick. Where would this guy be without that gimmick? Keith Lee does not fall into that category. The important thing is going to be how they use him on TV. More than the gimmick or the name is how they book him. So far, he has been booked strong. I would like to see that continue. Big E is going to need opponents. And guess what? Keith Lee would be a damn good opponent for Big E at some point. But this whole, like, all the gimmicky stuff, it's just such bullshit. Turns him into a cartoon character. Austin Theory is another man who has been racking up wins like Keith Lee has been doing of late on TV. He's someone else who could be a money player for them. So I'd like to see them not screw it up. He got a win over Dominic and took a selfie with the referee when it was over. Glad to see somebody is getting use out of Tyler Breeze's old gimmick. Seth Rollins was the lone heel in the main event with Finn Balor, Kevin Owens, and Rey Mysterio. That should have been a tip-off right there about who was going to win this ladder match, which went a little over 20 minutes, and I thought it was a fun stunt show. They had a contract hanging above the ring for a future WWE title match, one would think after Survivor Series. Kevin Owens looked like a man on a mission in this match. If any of these men needed a fresh start, it is Kevin Owens. Question is, will his contract status influence how hard he gets pushed going forward if he doesn't re-sign soon? Because his contract is up at the end of January. It's not that far off. We're only a couple of months away from January. And so he was out there, though. He was, you know, flying all over the place and giving it his all. Him losing here, and he said as much in a backstage segment with Finn Balor, he said, I need this. I need to win this match. And then he didn't. If that might possibly be the catalyst for a heel turn soon, I think that would be great. That certainly would be one way to freshen things up with Kevin Owens. But again, a lot of it is going to depend on how much do we want to invest in this guy and coming up with ideas for him if he hasn't committed to us. And he's, you know, 60 days or 90 days away from potentially leaving. We're not going to turn him heel and give him a big push and make him a number one contender for Big E's title. We're not going to put him in a top program on the show. That will be a very interesting story to follow in these next couple of months. Of course, Kevin Owens could turn around in a couple of weeks and sign a brand new 5-year deal. We don't know how this is going to play out. Rey Mysterio got powerbombed through a table on the floor by Owens. Rollins gave Owens a back body drop out of the ring and sent him crashing through a ladder bridge on the outside. So Rey was taken out, Owens was taken out, and then Rollins gave Balor a curb stomp in the ring to clear the field and pave the way for him to climb the ladder and pull down the contract. I wonder what Edge thinks about all this. Perhaps he'll tell us when he decides to come back in a few months. But a fun ending to the show, a show that did not have much to offer in the way of fun. It just felt like more of the same from the most uninspired, go-through-the-motions wrestling show anywhere on television. That is Monday Night Raw. Now, over on SmackDown, normally I would follow up with that by saying, well, at least we had SmackDown. This week is not one of those weeks. SmackDown was the definition of a throwaway show, airing on FS1 again after being bumped for the World Series on Fox. That meant no Roman Reigns, and boy, was this show exposed without him around. I have said it before, if this man ever gets hurt or he gets sick again and has to go away, they are in a lot of trouble. And this was only the second week of this new and improved SmackDown roster. At least Charlotte didn't have to be escorted out of the building this week that we know of. She said she spoke with Sonya Deville about wanting to give new people a chance at her title. This is when Sasha Banks came out and challenged her to a championship match. Charlotte said she wants to defend against new faces, and that brought out Shotzi Blackheart to take Charlotte up on her offer, and that led to, not a championship match, but it led to a championship contenders match. Boy, you know, I used to remember when people would beat people who were not the champion on TV to earn the right to eventually challenge the champion. But now they do this thing with championship contenders matches where they have the champion wrestling non-title matches against these same people instead of actually building up challengers in other ways. The best thing about their match that I could say is the fact that it went 11 minutes. That's longer than most women's matches get these days in WWE. The match itself, Charlotte was fine. This was not Shotzi's finest work. I didn't think she looked all that great here in this match. There was some awkwardness with the finish where Shotzi pushed Charlotte off into the ropes when Charlotte was going for the figure eight. You know, sometimes she'll do that little twirl to put the figure four on, and you kind of kick the person in the rear to kick your way out of it. So she did that with Charlotte. Sasha Banks is on the floor outside. Okay, she wasn't even up on the apron at this point. But Charlotte, as she gets kicked forward towards the ropes, stops short, like she was about to run into somebody. Maybe she was going to hit Darby Allin, the Invisible Man. She stops short, then Sasha climbs up onto the apron. So it may have been Sasha Banks who fucked up and missed her cue. So that was weird. But then it got weirder, because Charlotte moved out of the way like somebody looked at her and said, hey, look behind you. She thought somebody maybe was coming up from behind her. And Charlotte moves out of the way, but nobody was coming after her. Only after she moved did Shotzi come running in, and then she stopped short before she rammed into Sasha. This looked very bad. And Charlotte then hits Shotzi with Natural Selection, which she barely even sold. She didn't even really sell it. She was just sort of on her knees, and then Charlotte shoved her down onto the mat and pinned her for the 1-2-3. So there will be no championship match for Shotzi, and after that showing, there shouldn't be. What followed was Shotzi yelling at Sasha Banks for costing her the match and attacking her. Shotzi Blackheart turned heel. Or did she? And I say that because she attacked a heel. I know there's a lot of people who like Sasha. She still gets cheers when she comes out, but as far as any of us know, Sasha Banks on SmackDown is still a heel. Shotzi Blackheart attacked a heel. So unless I miss something, if a babyface attacks a heel and leaves her for dead, is she really a heel or is she just a very effective babyface? Now, on Talking Smack the next day, I did like the explanation that we got from Shotzi for why she did what she did. She said, "I am fed up. Plain and simple, I'm fed up. I am done being the happy, easygoing Shotzi. I have been screwed over on title opportunity after title opportunity. My tag team partner left me. I came here just wanting to have fun and kick ass. Well, you know what? I haven't had fun in a really long time. So there's just one thing left to do. Sasha was my breaking point, and now she is my target. I am not letting anybody walk over me anymore. I am running over everybody in my way." The woman gets called up to the main roster and admits that she hasn't had fun in a really long time. Coincidence? I think not. But I like that. I like that she pointed out that she and Tegan Nox earned a shot, which is what she was referring to. She and Tegan Nox earned a shot at the women's tag team titles in July. They earned that shot in July. They never did get their match against Natty and Tamina. They had other matches against Natty and Tamina. They got other wins over them too, but they never got their championship match. I'm still waiting for them to do something or anything with Toni Storm. She lost to Raquel Gonzalez in a dark match before SmackDown went on the air on Friday. That is not what Toni Storm should be used for. Put this woman on television and let her start getting over. I guarantee you she will if you give her the chance. And if they're serious about pushing Shotzi, I think her and Toni Storm both would be two fresh additions to the SmackDown Women's Division, depending on how they're used. But I like the explanation about the fact that, look, I've been fucked before on title opportunities, and this is now at least the second time, and I'm not going to take any more shit from anybody. Again, to me, that doesn't make her a heel. Everything she said there was 100% fact. So we call it a heel turn. I think that's what this was designed to be, but I think you might also run the risk of another Becky Lynch situation where people like Shotzi and they don't really want to boo her. We'll see if she can get the crowd to turn against her. After being attacked by Brock Lesnar last week, Adam Pearce was zooming in from his home and he announced that he was fining Lesnar $1 million. I got my pinky up to my mouth when I say that. $1 million for his actions, which loosely translated is one half of one Saudi payday. I always like how there are people who literally commit attempted murder on these shows. They don't get fined anything. But Brock Lesnar throws a few people around and he gets hit with a $1 million fine. Let's be honest. He is embarrassed. Adam Pearce is embarrassed that he split his pants on TV last week when Brock F5'd him, and so this is his punishment. Drew McIntyre was back with another open challenge this week, which was accepted by Mustafa Ali. He didn't last long, about 2 minutes before McIntyre tapped him out with a Kimura lock. It's the first time that I have ever seen Drew McIntyre win a match in WWE with a submission finish. I mean, maybe not ever, but I mean, I can't think of the last time I saw him win with a submission. We'll have to wait and see if there's a reason for that or if he just wanted to change things up himself. After the match, Ali said the only reason fans were booing him was because his name is Mustafa Ali. Nothing like playing the xenophobia card when you can't come up with something better for the man to do. But when you're stuck in the 1980s and Vince McMahon is surrounded by people like Bruce Pritchard, this is the sort of shit that you end up with. We had the King of the Ring, Xavier Woods, in the ring for a ceremony where he knighted Kofi Kingston, who is now Sir Kofi. We've gone from Sir Mo to Sir Kofi. I guess that would make Xavier Mabel, or, you know, give or take 400 pounds. They were interrupted by the Usos, who said that this is the Bloodline show now, and Woods declared a trial by combat between the two teams in the main event, otherwise known as a match. Non-title, of course. 2 weeks into the latest roster shakeup, and we are already back to the New Day against the Usos. It's like goddamn Groundhog Day every week with this company. I've never seen anything like it before in my life. When they say then, now, and forever at the start of every show, boy, do they mean it. On Dynamite Wednesday, we had AEW World Champion Kenny Omega dressed as a Ghostbuster. He was wrestling with a proton pack on his back. And we had the future AEW World Champion Hangman Page dressed as the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man. On Rampage on Friday, we had a trick-or-treat match with their women's champion. I bring all of this up because on this show, also on Friday night, we had a trick or street fight with Rick Boogs and the Intercontinental Champion Shinsuke Nakamura against Happy Corbin and Madcap Moss. Happy Corbin is fucking terrible. He was entertaining for about a minute when he was broke and destitute, and ever since he got his life together and picked himself up, he has gone right back to channel-changing heat with me. We got to get this man into a casino as soon as possible and let him blow all of his money. They had pumpkins everywhere, they had skeletons, and they had an apple bobbing tub outside the ring. Like the AEW stuff, it was mindless fun on a holiday-themed show. I thought this was fine. I felt the same way about this that I felt about that Dynamite main event on Wednesday. For a Halloween show, they did some Halloween shtick. I know one involved their world champion. I still can't get over the sight of their world champion wrestling in a fucking proton pack in the main event. But, again, Halloween show, Halloween theme. We get this every year. WWE is going to do it again when we get to Christmas. They'll have some kind of, you know, candy cane street fight or some bullshit. It was fine. Moss tried to dunk Boogs headfirst into the tub of apples. Boogs reversed. He dunked Moss headfirst into the tub. And the heels beat down Nakamura until Boogs came back. He hit Corbin and Moss with a series of pumpkins and various decorations. Rick Boogs ran wild. And Shinsuke beat the heels with a kendo stick. Nakamura went for the Kinshasa, but Moss put a pumpkin on his head. And Boogs climbed to the top rope, but two guys in Halloween costumes attacked Boogs. Turned out to be Humberto Carrillo and Angel Garza in costume. But Madcap took advantage and he scored the pin, so the heels picked up the win. Shayna Baszler beat Naomi with some help from Sonya Deville, beat her in about a minute. Sonya served as the special referee for the match. Naomi slipped on the ropes when she went for a springboard move at one point, which was unfortunate. She had the match won, but Sonya refused to count the fall. And when Shayna reversed, Deville fast counted for the win. Still no explanation for why Sonya Deville is so upset with Naomi. We are still left to wonder exactly what it is that this woman did to infuriate her so much. And the New Day bested the Usos, non-title. The Usos set up for opposite corner splashes on Sir Kofi when King Xavier pulled down Jey Uso. Jimmy went for the splash. Kingston got the knees up. Woods made a blind tag. Jey superkicked Kingston. He went for the pin, but Woods was the legal man, and he rolled him up for the win. A roll-up win to end an overall terrible edition of SmackDown this week. They very clearly gave up and threw the towel in because they were on FS1 this week, and it showed. Let us hope that the Tribal Chief returns next week. He's not even wrestling on a lot of these shows, but just his mere presence on the show makes the show feel more special. NXT 2.0 held its Halloween Havoc show on Tuesday, the first big show of the 2.0 era. It was no takeover, but it was, I thought, overall an enjoyable 2 hours with some Halloween shenanigans thrown in. They had a tie-in with the Chucky television series on USA. So they did these cut-ins with Chucky that were pretty lame. Io Shirai and Zoe Stark lost their NXT Women's Tag Team titles in a Scareway to Heaven ladder match against Indy Hartwell and Persia Parada. and Gigi Dolin and JC Jane. This was the second straight ladder match on WWE television this week. Raw on Monday night ended with a ladder match, and NXT on Tuesday opened with a ladder match. Talk about overkill. The one on Monday was better, but this wasn't the disaster I feared it might be, given the experience level of some of the people involved here. But there was a just terrifying ladder bump that Io Shirai took that scared the shit out of me. It looked even worse from the fan cam video that somebody shot inside the building, and they put it up on Twitter. I mean, my God, that looked even worse. Indy Hartwell shoved Io off this giant ladder in the ring, and Io crashed headfirst onto a ladder bridge outside the ring. Kevin Owens took a backdrop onto a ladder bridge 24 hours earlier, but this looked like she landed on her head before bouncing off and falling on the ground. After that, they went right to the finish with Gigi Dolin climbing up. She booted Hartwell off the ladder, and she grabbed the belts for the win. The right team won. Toxic Attraction has been getting the big push. I like them. I like Gigi Dolin. So I was happy to see her get the win. They threw a Joe Gacy squash match on the show and had Harland come out to the ring during his match, Michael Myers style, and grab his opponent by the throat before Gacy calmed him down and they left together. I guess he is officially a disciple of Gacy's now, although they haven't explained why. Every time I look at Gacy, I think of Louis Spicoli. I can't help it. It's the face. They just look similar to me. Malcolm Bivens was out with Diamond Mine issuing an open challenge. Boy, you know, now that I say it out loud, we are getting an awful lot of open challenges on TV, in WWE and in AEW as well. But I just talked about Drew McIntyre's open challenge on SmackDown on Friday. We had an open challenge here on NXT. Every fucking week we have open challenges. I mean, I'm fine with a good open challenge here and there, but I think we're at the point now where it's just sort of lazy booking, I think, when you can't really come up with something for people to do. So what do? Well, we'll have an open challenge. How about you just book a fucking match? How about that? But he threw out an open challenge, which was answered by Odyssey Jones, who chose Roderick Strong, the Cruiserweight Champion, a rematch from a match they had recently on 205 Live, which somehow still exists. When you have Odyssey Jones at 340 pounds wrestling on 205 Live, it might be time to call the fucking show something else. Unless the 205 represents the number of people who actually watch the show, which would make more sense. The Creed brothers interfered for the distraction, which allowed Strong to pick up the win with a jumping knee strike that took Jones down like a tree falling in the forest. Like Tim Burr, he just fell over. So Diamond Mine rolls on. I'm loving what they're doing with Diamond Mine right now. And Odyssey Jones has been humbled these past few weeks. He's been losing a number of matches, but it's all part of his development. I'm sure they have very high hopes for this guy. He's got the presence. He's got the charisma. He just has to put the pieces together in the ring, which he hasn't done yet. But I'm loving this Diamond Mine stuff. They've really turned a corner, because it looked for a little while there, and there was one member of Diamond Mine who got released, and I didn't know if they were going to just kind of nix the whole thing, and it was going to die like the whole Tian Sha thing has died, but they've really rebuilt that thing nicely. It was spin the wheel, make the deal for the NXT Women's Championship. Raquel Gonzalez defending against Mandy Rose. The wheel landed on Chucky's Choice. I thought it said Chuck E. Cheese at first. I'm sure there have been some soccer mom brawls at Chuck E. Cheese in this country. Chucky picked a trick or street fight. Raquel drove into the building on a motorcycle. It's a WWE street fight, so of course we got kendo sticks. There was a spot in the ring where Mandy got speared through a table. There was a mysterious cloaked figure who appeared, I assume the one from the vignettes on TV in the weeks leading up to the show, that was seen digging a grave in a graveyard somewhere. The person had a shovel, and the person hit Gonzalez in the back with it, which led to a boot to the face and a Mandy Rose pin. Mandy Rose is your new NXT Women's Champion. After the match, the cloaked figure pulled her hood off to reveal Dakota Kai, who has not been seen since losing to Raquel. She went undrafted, even though they called her up for a few dark matches. They drafted a lot of people who perhaps did not deserve to be drafted ahead of Dakota Kai. So their feud is going to continue, and Toxic Attraction has all the gold. They went the Evolution route with them, winning all the titles. I don't see another all-female faction sprouting up from this, but we may have a loose alignment of babyfaces fighting them in six-person tags. I could see that. You know, maybe they try to build a new babyface up to eventually challenge Mandy for the championship. Cora Jade. Look at Cora Jade. She's been getting some TV time recently. She would fit the bill. She just got a win over Electra Lopez the other week from Legado del Fantasma. But that's down the road. She's not been built up for that spot at all yet. She's just the one who I thought of. She definitely has that girl next door vibe to her, where I think she'll get over as a big baby face who people want to cheer for. Grayson Waller was hosting the show because LA Knight supposedly had car trouble, I guess. When Knight finally showed up to confront him, they were wearing the same vampire costume. They were interrupted by the debuting Solo Sikoa, the third Uso, the brother of Jimmy and Jay. You could see the resemblance, and so could the audience, who chanted Uso at him. He left Waller laying while LA Knight powdered out to the floor. Imperium are the new NXT Tag Team Champions, beating MSK to win the titles in the best match of the night. After covering the story last week about why MSK has been getting booed in the PC the past few months, they have been sabotaged by a vocal minority of fans. They were cheered on this show, just in time to see them drop the belts. It was spin the wheel, make the deal, and they landed on a lumberjack-o'-lantern match with wrestlers in Halloween costumes surrounding the ring. Nash Carter gave Marcel Bartel a cutter off the top onto the floor. And with all of the lumberjacks outside the ring, they had to have at least a dozen people out there. Not a single one of them bothered to catch Nash Carter on the way down. Ridiculous. Fabian Aichner hit Wes Lee with a deadlift brainbuster, which set up the European bomb for the win. Walter would be proud. The action in the final few minutes was real good, a much-needed win for Imperium, but I still think those titles end up on the Creed brothers before long. There were cutaways throughout the show to Carmelo Hayes and Trick Williams going through Dexter Lumis's haunted house, his haunted mansion, trying to recover Melo's North American title belt. This was a Jeremy Borash special. They were freaked out by a bunch of creepy people in costumes. They also ran into Andre Chase, who was in the house for some reason that was never explained. Melo found his title, and they warded off some zombies as they made a mad dash out of the house, while Lumis and Johnny Gargano scared them off. Silly, stupid fun, although I thought the end of this was pretty lame. And then we had the NXT Championship on the line. Tommaso Ciampa defending against Bron Breakker. They won't outright say that he is Rick Steiner's son, but they had Chucky take a shot at his father being dumb, which was a callback to an old Nitro segment with Rick Steiner and Chucky. Just acknowledge it already. Quit tap dancing around it. I don't see what the big deal is here. I understand they're not going to call him Steiner, which is dumb enough. But to sort of drop little hints and dance around it without actually saying it is just fucking dumb to me. I said last week when I ran down the predictions, I picked Tommaso Ciampa to retain. And I said that all Steiner had to do was go in there and hang with him and show that he belongs. And that's what he did. Is he green? Yes. Did he look a little gassed by the end? Yes. Would I still have put the championship on him? Yes. I think he looked good enough that he would have been just fine if they would have put the title on him here and let him get a run with it. I understand why they didn't. I like Ciampa. I like, you know, him being the champion a little bit longer is okay with me. But please spare me the exaggerated takes that it would have somehow derailed his career if he had won the NXT title here. He would have been fine. He would have been fine. Outside of one botch where he slipped off the middle rope, which could happen to anybody. It happened to Naomi on Friday. He looked more than capable in the ring. I'm impressed by how quickly he has picked this up and how comfortable he sounds on the microphone. I love the Frankensteiner that he hit, although I might not be doing those in every match. I don't know that bodes well for your long-term health. They spilled outside to the floor where the mat had been pulled up, exposing the concrete, and Ciampa gave him a DDT on the floor, which busted open the top of his forehead. Ciampa hit the fairy tale ending, but Steiner kicked out. So he hit him with another one, and that was enough to finish him off. So it took two of Ciampa's finishers to finish off this kid. Again, they really put him over strong, even in defeat. I thought the match and the finish were designed in such a way to keep him looking as strong as possible. His time will come, but not on this night. Perhaps Santos Escobar could be next in line for a match with Ciampa for the NXT Championship. But that's your Halloween Havoc review. I didn't have any time to put together a mailbag here. If you're a channel member on YouTube, you got a gigantic mailbag. I answered your questions on there, over an hour's worth. So don't forget to check out those two parts. We'll get back to your mailbag questions on the show here next week. There's a lot going on this week. So I said, you know what? We'll have a little bit of a shorter show here for Halloween. We'll regroup. We'll come back. Celebrate the anniversary next week. Hopefully you will join me for that. I'll probably end up doing what I did last year. We'll probably do a separate actual celebration, like an anniversary stream on YouTube. Probably just taking more of your questions or something. I'll figure that out. But next week is episode 729. That is going to technically be 14 years, the 14-year anniversary of this podcast. And I do want to take a moment to thank everybody. I say thank you every week. But when I stop and think about, you know, all the shows I've done, but also the audience I've been able to build up through the audio show, through the YouTube channel, on social media, and the Facebook group, and just all over the place, and the people I've met, the friends I've made, the fun that I have still, even with bad television, the fun that I have doing these shows, the fact that I have been able to, you know, get it to a point where I can actually make a living off of this, and, you know, this takes up more of my time than anything else that I do at this point, so I wouldn't have it any other way, and none of that would be possible without your support. And so I want to thank you for that, because it's become a very big part of my life, and it just would not be happening if I didn't have all of you tuned in each and every week, whether you've been listening since episode one or whether you've been a new listener only for about a month or two. Hopefully you will stick with me and be here, because next year we're going to celebrate 15 years. You talk about a celebration, we'll have to do something special for that. But we got to get through 14 first. 729 will be next Sunday. And actually, less than a week after that, the following Friday, November 12th, it's coming up pretty quick. House of Glory, Born Again, from the NYC Arena in Queens, New York, live on Fight TV. So if you're not in New York, or if you didn't buy a ticket and there's only general admission seating left, first, second, and third rows are sold out. If you can't be there live, you can watch live on Fight TV. I'll be back on commentary along with JD. We'll be calling the entire show, including the big main event of the Amazing Red one-on-one against Will Ospreay. A lot of other big matches planned as well. So I'm very much looking forward to what is on tap in November with House of Glory, with Full Gear. Survivor Series is coming up. So until then, be well, stay safe. Have yourselves a very happy Halloween if you are celebrating, or if you are going out I'm telling you, go out and trick or treat, and you can steal candy from people. It's fun. What's not to like? Who doesn't like candy? I dated a girl once named Candy. Didn't last very long, but anyway, I'll see you guys next week. Happy Halloween, and I'll see you on Wednesday for the Dynamite stream. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
What is the point of Tony Schiavone even coming down to the ring to do these interviews if every single time they pull the microphone out of his hand?
There were a couple of AEW diehards who got very upset. Oh my God, you're criticizing.
But these will be the first fucking people. If WWE did something like this, oh, they'd be online. Oh my God, WWE, look at this. What a shit product. God forbid you say something negative about AEW. Holy shit. The world is just falling down all around us. You people gotta cool your jets. Don't tell me what to tweet on my Twitter. You can go fuck yourself.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @Sala Monster.
Sala Monster. Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.